This episode of the Lawfare Podcast is brought to you by Blinkist. Fit more listening and reading into your life with key takeaways from the best nonfiction books. Get a free 7-day trial at Blinkist.com/lawfare.
Fundamentally, I think I say this with reasonable confidence, we do not lie awake at night wondering about the next step in U.S.-Russia relations. We are confident that this administration, and we note that it contains people like John Bolton and Mike Pompeo, and is backed by a Congress that includes people like Tom Cotton and Lindsey Graham, that this is an administration that's going to do the right thing on Russia. We're just confident about that. So, yes, we read all the pronouncements that come out of the administration as well as watching its actions. But I promise you, this is not something that is keeping people awake at night in London. And if we look at the evidence of the last 2 years, that confirms us in that judgment.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, March 30th, 2019. There's a special relationship between the United States and the United Kingdom. But with Brexit and the erratic presidency of Donald Trump, it hasn't exactly been business as usual between the two countries. Or has it? British Ambassador to the United States, Sir Kim Darroch, sat down with me last week to talk about the alliance, particularly at moments of uncertainty for both countries. We talked briefly about Brexit, but mostly discussed other key areas of mutual cooperation, counterterrorism in the Middle East, countering Russian aggression, and what to do about a rising China. The discussion of Brexit predated this week's events in Parliament, so the situation now is a little different than when we recorded on Monday. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 404, Ambassador Kim Darroch on the state of the special relationship. So I think of this conversation as like, you know, the special relationship when both parties have gone insane. and I want to start, we're here to talk about other things, but it would be positively odd of us not to start by dealing with the two big elephants in the room. That is to say, our domestic politics and your domestic politics. Let's start with that. I mean, this is a remarkable time for the relationship between the UK and the United States, both because of events in the UK and because of events in the United States. I'm interested just in your thoughts on that sort of macro situation where we have this historic relationship, this very close and intimate relationship at a time of real upheaval in both countries.
Well, Ben, look, these are exceptional times, you're right, and they've made for an interesting time for me as ambassador to the US. Any British ambassador to the US has an interesting, exceptionally interesting and rewarding job, but these times have been extraordinary. All that said, what we're seeing, I think, on both sides of the Atlantic is we're seeing democracy in action, and that's what's capturing the headlines. And I can talk a bit more about what's going on in the House of Commons this week, if that's of interest to you. But then if you look underneath these extraordinary events at the foundations of the UK-US relationship, they are extraordinarily solid and strong and deep and broad. If you just take, for example, the national security relationship, defense field, there is an amazing amount of interaction. There are 1,000 Brits embedded in your armed forces at any one time. There's a huge amount of cooperation goes on between the two of us. And we stand alongside US forces and have done now for decades wherever there are principles and values to be upheld and wherever there is danger for the international community. If you look at the intelligence relationship, it's never been stronger. The trade relationship is really exceptional. If you add together investment and commerce, there's $1 trillion worth going on between the two economies. And then if you go beyond that to shared history, to cultural interaction, to all of these things that make up what is genuinely a special relationship, it all looks to me to be absolutely thriving.
And yet we've had certain incidents in the past several years that are genuinely different. I mean, we have a long history of sort of dealing with whatever government exists in the other country without a whole lot of comment on the domestic politics of one another's countries. And yet the president has made no secret of his views of certain matters of British domestic affairs, including, for example, Brexit, including also, you know, how the mayor of London responds to terrorist incidents. And so I'm curious, that level of, some of that is simply a function of the personality of the individual, but some of it raises intergovernmental questions. I'm curious to what extent the sort of difficulty of the personality in the White House matters from a British point of view.
I think there's a few ways to tackle that very fair question. First of all, just to say that in terms of relationship between governments, Prime Minister and the President talk regularly on the telephone. Whenever they're together at the same international meeting, they will meet bilaterally and have a substantive conversation. President was in the UK last July. We know he'll be back in the UK this December because we're hosting the NATO summit. So at that level, there's a lot of interaction. It's very businesslike. It's very useful. It's effective. And, you know, they agree about lots of things. I remember most recently the Prime Minister supporting the President strongly on the need for NATO countries to fulfill their commitments to spend 2% of GDP on defense. So that's the kind of thing where we work together very closely. If you look below that level to the ministerial relationships, say Jeremy Hunt, our Foreign Secretary, and Mike Pompeo, or the Defense Secretaries Patrick Shanahan and Gavin Williamson, those relationships are very strong. I mean, I monitor them. I'm there when they meet, at least when they meet in the US, and they're very strong. So senior levels, government to government, they're very strong. We have parliamentarians coming over all the time. There are always CODELs going across to London and British parliamentarians coming here. And there is genuine friendship across between the two parliaments, as there is between the senior legal communities, Supreme Courts on both sides, and that kind of thing. And then you get people-to-people relationships, which are very strong. Now, of course, as you highlighted, this president is different from some of his predecessors in the way that he sets out his views, his use of Twitter, and the comments that he makes on the international situation. If you look at Brexit, the thing that has really mattered to us has been his support for a future free trade deal between the UK and the US once we have left the European Union, and his support for us setting up the structures to prepare for that, which we've done. And only a couple of weeks ago, he actually tweeted that he was looking forward to a comprehensive and ambitious free trade deal. So that's the substance, and that's what matters, and that's what we look forward to working with the US on in the months to come.
So, you know, the reciprocal confusion is that when people in the United States look over at the UK now, literally this week, we don't know for sure that Brexit is happening, although, you know, we don't know when it's happening, and we don't know by what means precisely it happens. And so, you know, as you represent the UK in Washington, what is the message about where this process is going and, you know, how Americans should understand the UK government's posture both in relation to the United States as the UK goes through Brexit, but also in relation to the rest of the world?
Again, those are very Good questions. First thing to say is, much as I love and enjoy this city, I try not to spend all my time in Washington. At least once a month, I try to get out to one of the other states, and I've done in my 3 years here 30 states now, just more than 30. What is interesting about Brexit is I do get asked about Brexit an awful lot, but not just in Washington. I was down in Arkansas 3 weeks ago, and I was asked about Brexit everywhere there too. So it's kind of broken through. It's not just a Washington bubble issue. It's an issue that has penetrated through to Americans in all walks of life across the country, and people are interested. They're mostly interested just to understand what is going on. It's not they want to express their views. Well, later in the conversation, they might say whether they agree or disagree with it. But first of all, they just want to understand what is going on, which I can understand because we have a parliamentary process that's different from the way your Congress does business and must look confusing. There's a lot of theater to it that people also enjoy to an outsider. What I tell people about what's happening in the UK now is, however confusing and uncertain it may look, this is democracy in action. This is a very, very big decision. You know, we've been in the European Union, started off when we joined as the European Economic Community since 1 January 1973. People chose for a range of reasons, but by a clear majority, 17.4 million to I think 16.1 million in June 2016, that they wanted to leave. And since then, the government has been trying to negotiate the terms of its exit. So what we're discussing at the moment is the withdrawal agreement. We still have to negotiate the future arrangements. But Parliament has so far declined to approve the deal that the government has done. So we're now just a few days off the 29 March deadline for completing negotiations and leaving. The deadline was set in what's called Article 50 of the European treaties. So it's 2 years from the day that you announce, you file a letter with the institutions in Brussels saying you want to leave, 2 years from that. So we did that on the 29th of March 2017. 2 years on from that, 29 March 2019. That was the date we were meant to leave. What happened last week was because Parliament has declined to approve the deal that the government did, we went to the European Union, Prime Minister went to the European Summit on Thursday, Friday, and asked for an extension of the negotiating process. That was granted, though it's a complicated thing because it says if you now get your deal approved, you have until the 22nd of May to do the secondary legislation that you need to do just to get everything properly authorized for the leaving day. If the deal doesn't get approved, then you need to decide by the 12th of April what you want to do. Today, it's happened and happening now, I guess, the Prime Minister is having a meeting with her cabinet, and then she will go to Parliament this afternoon to set out to report to Parliament on what happened at the European Council next week and to say something about what happens next. And in advance of her making that statement, I don't myself know what she is going to say about what happens next. There's lots of speculation, which I can go into if you like, but we won't know until the Prime Minister makes a statement, and she will be clearing her lines now with Cabinet. But she'll make a statement this afternoon, and then we take it from there. But I think I'm confident that her primary objective will remain to get the government's deal approved by Parliament, because she believes, the cabinet believes, and I agree with them, by the way. I did 15 years of my career on European Union stuff, on negotiating with the EU, that this is simply the best deal that is available, actually the only deal that is available. And to get it approved, you need to switch 75 votes to vote the other way. She lost about 149 last time. And I think there is a reasonable chance that she can do that. If it doesn't look like it's going to happen, there may not be a third vote on the deal. But if you see that scheduled in the next few days in Parliament, it means I think the government is confident that it can win. So let's see what unfolds.
So by the time anybody hears this, this will have played out, and so it'll be interesting to go back and evaluate this against what happened over the next few days. So let's turn to the many areas of British and American security cooperation where partnership that, you know, we used to talk about all the time and that are getting squeezed out of the room by these two giant elephants. Let's start with Syria. So the president threw you guys a curveball and threw everybody a curveball around the turn of the year with the sort of announcement of the Syria withdrawal. That has obviously not materialized quite the way it was appears to have been envisioned. But, you know, you guys are still there as well. So let's talk about Syria and where things are from a British perspective in that conflict.
Yeah. First thing to say is that there was some good news yesterday over the weekend, because the last significant town, the last piece of Syrian territory held by ISIS forces, fell to the coalition. It doesn't mean that the ISIS threat has been eliminated. Obviously, some of those ISIS fighters will have escaped and will still be somewhere around in the region. But as not to deny the significance and the symbolism of the last town that they held falling to the coalition. So that's been a successful military process. And we've played a part in it as part of the coalition alongside the US. We just need to recognize that.
And walk through what the British role in the coalition has been.
Look, we've done some training of the forces that have played part in it. And we have...
These are the Kurdish forces.
And we have been part of the air cover and the airstrikes for a long time now. Basically, we've been contributing throughout the preparations for and then the operation to retake that territory.
And so as a lot of this conflict is sort of invisible to people, the ISIS sweep across Iraq and Syria was obviously a big thing when it happened, and it was very much at the center of people's attention, and then it kind of isn't anymore. How would you characterize the sort of scope and magnitude of the British commitment in Syria?
Well, what I want to say, Ben, was first of all, register that success. My second point was going to be that we were, as you hinted, surprised initially at the president's decision or announcement on withdrawal. And now that that is playing out, and we're discovering through military to military channels what it means, decisions are still to be taken, I think, on both sides of the Atlantic. But if there is an enduring US presence of some dimension, then I think we are likely to be part of that at about the same level, the same sort of involvement as we have at the moment, unless you come to us and say you want us to do more, in which case, of course, as always, as your strongest and most reliable ally, we will consider it. In terms of the future in Syria, yes, we have cleared ISIS out from their last chunk of territory, though there is still some threat there. But Syria is still a country that has been destroyed by civil war, where there is no functioning central government across the whole of the territory, where neighbors, in particular Turkey, are still concerned about what is going on, and where we need a political process at some point to try and establish peace across the country and see if there's any way we can put it back together. We're concerned about Russian presence in Syria. We're obviously very concerned about Iranian involvement in Syria. And those things need to be pushed back as well. So there's a lot still to be done in Syria. And if in the light of all that, the US administration decides that this confirms on a continuing presence and decides it needs to be prolonged. Obviously, I can't commit my government here and now, but I think we would be keen to work with you on you know, on the future strategy.
There was an initial great surprise both domestically and internationally at the president's announcement. Since then, there has been this very careful dance of kind of, I'll say it so you don't have to, backtracking and reaffirmation of commitments that appeared to be swept off the table in that initial set of announcement. At this point, does the UK government understand what the US policy as to its own commitment in Syria is? And is it a policy that, you know, from a UK perspective, gives you guys the confidence you need in order to formulate your own policy with respect to your own presence there?
2 points. First point is to say, yes, the timing of the announcement was a surprise, Ben. But this president, when he was candidate Trump and campaigning, was very clear many, many times on the campaign trail about his intention to pull the US back from some of its foreign involvement, especially in the Middle East. So in a sense, yes, timing was a surprise, but the substance of it had always been in the pipeline somewhere, you kind of think. And so in that sense, this was to be expected. In terms of where things now are, as I said earlier, final decisions haven't been taken. But I think the talks that are going on, essentially military to military, at a very senior level, are productive and are good and are to do with what we do together in the future and how we what our objectives are in particular for the future. And of course, they also need to talk about exit strategies and end dates and that kind of thing. Alongside that, the foreign policy specialists, the Syria specialists, led by Ambassador Jeffrey in your case, are talking to our people a lot, almost daily. And we and my team in the embassy that cover this area are talking to State Department and to the NSC daily as well. So, yes, there's an awful lot of interaction. Yes, there is a pretty good understanding and shared objectives and similar analysis of what needs to be done or what needs to happen. Let's see when recommendations from this process reach senior levels, political levels in my government and obviously the president and the secretary of state in your government, and decisions are taken. Whether we're in the same place then, but my expectation is if we prepare things well, then we will be. And Ambassador Jeffrey in particular keeps reminding us all that the objectives include, Iran out of Syria, ISIS defeated, and a political process that can lead to broad peace settlement in the country. And those are objectives we all share.
The Lawfare podcast has a sponsor. It's Blinkist. You may think you don't have time to read a book or to develop yourself. You may not know what's out there to read, or you may find the volume of content out there overwhelming. The Blinkist app helps solve these problems. Blinkist is the app that gives you the key takeaways, the information you really need to know from thousands of nonfiction books, and distills them down so you can read or listen to them as 15-minute segments. Blinkist is for busy people who want to listen to the main points of books quickly without reading the whole thing. It's for people who need help deciding what books to really dive into and which ones you're happy digesting just the main points of. Blinkist has a massive and always growing library that includes many nonfiction topics, self-help, business, health, and history. With its audio feature, Blinkist makes it easy to finish highlights from as many as 4 books a day. And it's got a lot of titles that listeners of the Lawfare podcast will find interesting. For example, yesterday at the gym, I listened to the Blinkist audio of Hannah Arendt's The Origins of Totalitarianism. No, that's not a joke. I really did. And you can, too. I also listened to Start With Why by Simon Sinek. I'm still new to Blinkist, but if you're looking to figure out what books are out there and which ones you need to pay more attention to, and you want to do this while you're on the subway, while you're doing the dishes, or while you're working out, I recommend it. So, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for listeners of the Lawfare podcast. Go to Blinkist.com/lawfare to start your 7-day free trial. That's Blinkist, spelled BLINKIST.com/lawfare to start your free 7-day trial. Again, Blinkist.com/lawfare. Let's turn to Russia more generally. You mentioned Russia's role in Syria and kind of pushing back against that, but Russian aggressiveness in general has been a matter that, for different but also overlapping and deeply related reasons, both countries have faced over the last few years. Both countries have had a certain amount of electoral interference. In addition, you guys have had murders in the streets of your countries using chemical agents. And it is against this backdrop that, on the one hand, the U.S. has imposed a lot of sanctions, done a lot of sort of appropriate things. But on the other hand, Helsinki is a jarring moment for anybody who's concerned about, you know, Russian aggression. And in the same vein, the degree of Russian investment in, for example, the city of London is extreme in real estate in London. So how should we understand sort of British and American common interests with respect to Russia and common current policy with respect to Russia?
Big question. The kind of best outward manifestation of UK and US perceptions, common perceptions of Russia, came in relation to the incident you mentioned, Ben, which was agents of the Russian state using Novichok in a small and quiet British market town in a failed attempt to kill a couple of Russian exiles, but with the collateral death of a British woman who happened to pick up the receptacle that they had been using to hold this extraordinarily lethal concoction in. And moreover, I mean, that whole action was an extraordinarily irresponsible and dangerous piece of behavior that put basically the entire population of a British city at risk. Now, what we saw after that was UK taking action to expel a number of so-called Russian diplomats who we believed were Russian intelligence agents from the UK. And then the US basically led the international reaction by expelling 60 Russians from 60 Russian diplomats from the US. And on the back of that, you saw a lot of further expulsions from European and other countries. I think the end total was close to 150. So that was real, A, US solidarity with the UK, and B, U.S. leadership of the international community in responding to completely appalling Russian behavior. In terms of Britain's future relations with Russia, look, they're in a difficult place at the moment, and they will be so long as Russia is doing what it does, not just what happened in Salisbury, but the intimidation and meddling that we see across Europe, what they're doing in the Middle East, where, by the way, they are, amongst other things, supporting in Syria a regime that has used chemical weapons against its own people, and other activities that you see Russia involved in around the world. And my impression is that in terms of sanctions policy and general rhetoric and actions, the US government is in pretty much an identical place and has actually brought in a lot more sanctions on Russia since this administration, since it came into office. Alongside that, you raise the Helsinki summit and the president's relationship with Putin.
And related sort of public solicitude that kind of cuts against the grain of some of the policy that's been made.
Yeah. I mean, we tend to focus on you know, what the president and the administration do. But just one point on the kind of relationship, the top level between the White House and the Kremlin. It's a good thing, we think, for international stability and security if there is a functioning, effective channel between the White House and the Kremlin, and a relationship between the president of the United States and the Russian president. That's a good thing for the world, provided that that channel is used to put some tough messages across to Russia about those activities that we in the international community think are unacceptable and destabilizing and bad for international stability and security. And the president is right to want to have a relationship with Vladimir Putin. And we trust that when they speak, and I guess, there will be another summit at some stage, we trust that he will use that relationship and that channel and that occasion to put some tough messages across about what Russia is doing. One of the things we notice, for example, is that the White House took a tough position over what the Russians did with that Ukrainian vessel recently and is still demanding the release of those Ukrainian sailors that are kept. And that's the right position to take because we don't think that what the Russians did there was legal.
So you sound quite unconcerned in a way that I think a lot of listeners and, would say, well, okay, he's being very diplomatic. Surely at Whitehall, when they hear the president talk this way about Vladimir Putin, they're not saying, gosh, it's good that he's trying to develop that kind of close rapport relationship. Just hope that he conveys tough messages when the door is closed. So I guess I'm not asking you to, by any means to sort of, denounce the president in this regard. But I am curious. There has to be, when there is this much dissonance between the rhetoric and content of U.S. policy, there has to be at least a little bit of concern about that dissonance and what the messages that are being sent from the most senior leadership look like. And I'm curious, you said that you tend to evaluate what the United States does rather than what the president says. Is that the sort of general resolution of that sort of thing, that you just kind of like, you just kind of don't focus on the words that are spoken, or is there other mechanisms of managing that concern as well?
And I mean, we do focus, obviously, on words as well as actions. And, we all of us check our Twitter accounts in the morning. But fundamentally, I think I say this with reasonable confidence, we do not lie awake at night wondering about the next step in U.S.-Russia relations. We are confident that this administration, and we note that it contains people like John Bolton and Mike Pompeo, and is backed by a Congress that includes people like Tom Cotton and Lindsey Graham, that this is an administration that's going to do the right thing on Russia. We're just confident about that. So, yes, we read all the pronouncements that come out of the administration as well as watching its actions. But I promise you, this is not something that is keeping people awake at night in London. And if we look at the evidence of the last 2 years, that confirms us in that judgment.
So the reciprocal question is that, the UK itself has these very complicated Russian relationships, including, as I mentioned earlier, a huge amount of sort of Russian oligarch investment in London real estate. And London as a sort of financial center in Europe has sort of attracted a lot of, Russian attention and presence. And I know that that has raised concerns in Britain as well as elsewhere about the sort of exploitation of British law, British investment opportunities for money laundering by Putin's friends and associates. I'm curious to what extent the UK has sort of its own house in order in terms of controlling and pushing back against Russian aggression.
It is true that there are quite a number, many of them very wealthy, of Russians which now use London, use the UK as their second home, or in some cases, their first home. And that there is a growing Russian community. There's always been a Russian community in London, by the way. Almost every nationality has a community in London. It's always been there, but it is now bigger, and there are some very prominent and very wealthy individuals there. One or two of them even own, you know, prominent British football clubs, which certainly brings a lot of publicity with it. It is true also that there are concerns about the source of all the Russian money. I mean, London is simply one of the world's three great financial centers. And as the main financial center in Europe, it's the place where if you're going to invest your money, that you're going to come. So there's an obvious reason why London has proved such an attraction for these wealthy individuals. Plus, London property has always been a very good investment. So, you know, there are normal reasons for all of that. But yes, we are concerned about some of the reports about where this money has come from. And have actually introduced some legislation designed to empower our law enforcement agencies to take action if we think money has been acquired illegally and that it is being used, is being laundered through London or whatever. There is still some work to be done on that. I wouldn't claim that our legislative defenses are complete. They're not. And I can't, I'm afraid, quite remember all the individual actions, but I know that there is some legislation already introduced here, not just in relation to Russians, by the way, because there are a lot of wealthy people who bring their money to London. And, you know, it's not just about Russians. But we are doing what we need to do. We're not there yet, but we're doing what we need to do to build up our defenses and our powers to intervene if we think that illegal activity is going on. So the problem is being addressed.
There is no institution more exquisitely designed over a long period of time to deal with the Russian threat than NATO. And the UK and the United States are historically cornerstone pillars of NATO. One of the things, and this I think is entirely on the fault of the United States side of this, has raised a question over the last few years of the US commitment to NATO. I am interested for your sense of the stability and fortitude of the alliance and how confident you are that nothing that the President of the United States has said on the subject should give people in the UK or in the United States reason to doubt the seriousness and vitality of the alliance.
We're confident about the US commitment to NATO, but we think that the president has a point, and he's not the first US president to make it, about the failure of, what I have to say, is a majority of NATO members to live up to commitments they have made. When I was National Security Advisor, which I did from 2012 to 2015, I presided over the NATO summit that we had in Wales, where everyone recommitted to 2% of GDP on defense and 20% of that 2% spent on equipment. And the fact is that as of now, there's only, I think, four or five NATO countries that have reached that 2%. However, we should recognize that primarily under pressure from the US, but also, you know, because countries are trying to live up to their commitments, that an extra 40, that since President Trump came into office, an extra $40 billion is being spent by NATO members on defense, and that I think by 2020, it will be 8 or 9 NATO members that will have hit 2%, and by 2024, a number others will get there. So the picture is improving, and I think this administration can take credit for successful exercise in pressure and exhortation in rhetoric in getting other NATO countries to do better. There is still a way to go, and we should be in a position, you know, where all 28 members of NATO are spending 2%, but that's not going to be the case even by 2024, I fear. So there's a lot more to be done. There are two major junctions this year. First, it's actually, I think, in only a few days' time when Mike Pompeo has invited all NATO foreign ministers to Washington to celebrate the 70th anniversary of NATO. And that will be an opportunity for collective discussion and collective, you know, recommitment to do what is what others already promised to do, which is get to 2%, but also to talk about NATO's, the success that is represented by the 70 years of the NATO alliance, and about the challenges for the future, which are considerable. And then we in the UK are hosting the NATO summit again in December. I don't know whether it'll be in London or where it'll be in the UK. And that will be an opportunity to welcome President Trump to back to the UK, and to consider where we are at the end of the year. And again, to think about NATO's objectives and its tasks, but also how we are doing on delivering on our joint commitments. So it's a big year for NATO. But the picture is better than it was 2 years ago.
Okay, so I take as granted that Trump has put the fear of God in certain NATO allies about actually meeting, you know, or coming closer to meeting spending commitments on defense than those countries had been willing to do before. This has been, in this sense, you can understand what Trump has said about NATO as he's kind of playing bad cop, and the prior administrations were playing good cop, and actually having a certain amount of bad cop has some salutary effects. But I do worry in relation to our prior part of the conversation about Russia, what the message that this sends to Russia is. That, you know, here on the one hand, we are trying to convey consistent messages of non-interference in these countries. We're trying to convey consistent messages of deterrence, and we're trying to convey that, you know, ultimately that an attack on one is an attack on all, and that we will, as the president is still incredulous about, we will defend Montenegro if we have to, right? And I do worry that the repeated statements about raising questions about that. In fact, you will say, I'll watch what the United States does and won't pay too much attention. But Vladimir Putin may actually listen to what the president's saying and say, you know what? I don't really believe that. I really don't believe he's going to do anything to protect Ukraine. So we'll just deal with Eastern Ukraine. We've already seen that, and that was under the previous administration. But how much do I really believe that he's going to do everything that NATO is committed to doing to protect Latvia? I wonder about the erosion of NATO's deterrence as a result of repeated, even if you're completely right that he never actually does anything other than honoring NATO's commitments, just heighten the possibility that the international messaging of it gives bad actors, and particularly Russia, the wrong idea about what it can get away with, including in the streets of small UK market towns.
Yeah, and you're right, of course, that it's important that our messaging about NATO's solidarity and our collective commitments, our adherence to NATO treaty, that it's important that we continue to send clear and strong messages about that. If I were Vladimir Putin, though, I would also look at what NATO is doing, and I would note that, remember, Russia is, you know, by the standards, the collective standards of NATO, Russia is quite a small economy. I would look at what NATO is doing, the $40 billion extra spent since 2016. Cast that forward to 2024, that'll be $100 billion extra on equipment. At the extraordinary quality of the technology that is being used and developed. And beyond that, the fact that NATO has now deployed more forces to its eastern border, including, by the way, some British forces that are now forward deployed in, I think Estonia. And, you know, look at all of those actions. Look at how NATO is improving its capabilities and is pushing forces into places that where reassurance is needed. And I don't think I would feel at the end of that I'm on a very positive or encouraging trajectory in challenging NATO. We're also in NATO looking at all those so-called asymmetric threats, at the risk from offensive cyber and all these things, taking action on that. So NATO basically, I would say, is getting its act together impressively. And if I were sitting in Moscow, I would be looking at that and thinking that NATO is responding.
Let's talk about the other great geopolitical challenge before we wrap up. China, on the one hand, is not physically present in the same way that Russia is, but it looms very, very large, and particularly for US-UK purposes in the cyber domain. This is an area where the two countries work extremely closely together. But I wanna talk specifically about China as a challenge for the US-UK relationship. And it comes up in the Huawei context and the discussions over that. It also just comes up in the broader challenge of cybersecurity. And so I'm interested in, this is an area where, again, the president has been very, very vocal. And I'm curious for your thoughts about what the nature of that challenge is for the sort of traditional US-UK relationship and alliance.
Yeah. We talk to the administration about China issues at various levels all the time. So I have a China specialist in my team here who spends his life in State Department and the NSC, and a national security advisor. My successor as national advisor was over a couple of weeks back and saw John Bolton and Mike Pompeo and Patrick Shanahan and others around the U.S. system. And China was one of the major subjects for discussion there. Honestly, and I wouldn't say that there is tension in the relationship. There is a lot of shared analysis and a very valuable and fruitful and enlightening discussion about where we think China is going and what we think about how to handle relations with China. You talk about, you mentioned rightly, Huawei as one of the issues. Now, certainly the UK, we are still looking at the issue of, Chinese equipment on our future 5G networks and how that is, whether it should be allowed and controlled and what the security, national security implications are of that. And I don't think any decisions have been taken in the US system about that either, not final decisions about that issue. So there's a lot we can talk about there as well. But I would just say on Huawei that we have long been concerned about having their equipment on our, what's now currently 4G network. We have a center in the UK that looks at every single piece of Huawei kit that might be incorporated in our communications network, that tests it for loopholes or for weaknesses, that occasionally goes back to the company and says you have to address that before you can put it on the system. It's a more developed system than anywhere else in the world. We are the only ones who do this. That's our approach to handling this particular issue and this particular challenge. And we think it works well. And we compare notes with the US system, with US experts on it. And I think that they acknowledge that it's one coherent approach to this challenge. So you can go down the banning route, or you can go down the route we've gone, which is to really challenge each individual piece of equipment and see if it is viable for our systems. I don't know what will happen with 5G in future, which route we will take, but it's something on which we are having good, not tension-filled discussions, but good discussions with the U.S. on the way forward. And we would hope to find an agreed way forward that we're both happy with. So that's the Huawei issue. More generally, on cybersecurity, look, we both suffer from theft of our intellectual property. We both suffer from cyber attacks from Chinese companies, some of them quite closely connected with the state. We're both trying to address this issue. We're both of us developing offensive cyber capabilities. So cyber is another area of active US-UK collaboration. And it's very important in the modern world, and we'll continue.
So when a senior diplomat says to me two times in 10 minutes, these conversations, I wouldn't say tension-filled. I wouldn't say there's tension. I'm imagining a room of people with their teeth clenched and having what diplomats might also call a frank exchange of views on the subject. Actually sounds like a pretty substantial policy difference. You know, we've just indicted the company. We're seeking the extradition of a senior officer of the company from a third, you know, allied country, Canada. And we are trying to get it out of, you know, really discourage countries from using it. And you guys are taking the position, hey, we're fly-specking the technology really, really carefully, and that's good enough for us. Is there a layer to this that there is British suspicion that U.S. concerns are grounded in trade competitiveness questions, or is this just a different view of how dangerous this situation is and what the best national security approaches to addressing it look like?
If I gave the impression, Ben, that these are jaw-clenching discussions with, deeply frankly, honestly, they're not. And I speak from personal experience because when I was National Security Advisor, our own parliament asked us to review, the government, to do a report for parliament reviewing our security arrangements around Huawei equipment. And I had to produce myself. In fact, I wrote most of it, you know, a kind of lengthy 50, 60-page report on what we were doing, whether it needed tightening up, and I suggested half a dozen different ways in which we tightened it up, and a sort of explanation of why we were where we were. I remember talking at that time to US experts quite a lot and comparing our approaches on Huawei kit, and I remember not having my jaw clenched at all during those discussions. They were all fine, I promise you, and that's, I've sat in the discussion since then where I think, but I can't speak for the US system, but my impression from where I sit is the US understand and basically appreciate how we handle Huawei kit in our 4G network. And they, you know, they, I'm not going to speak for them and say they are cool with it, but I don't get any impression from them that they are really seriously worried about it. They think that it works. Now, 5G is different. It's a very different form of network, and that's why this is still being discussed and we're still thinking about what we do. We're still thinking about whether the approach that we have taken hitherto works for 5G. So that's a kind of unknown unknown out there. But honestly, in terms of the discussions we are having, they are genuinely collaborative and genuinely seeing if we can find a way through together. Because apart from anything else, there is a real question about whether you can construct these new 5G networks in all of the alliance countries without using some Chinese equipment. And by the way, equipment that is not Chinese, could be American, could be Swedish, whatever, is also mostly made in China. So it's a really difficult issue. So I think we're collectively trying to find a way forward, not kind of at deep odds with decisions already taken. There's only one country that has banned Huawei kit so far for its 5G network. I think that's Australia. The rest of us are still thinking on what the right way through is here. And I still think there's a very good chance we can find a way that is collaborative and where we're all in the same place.
Mr. Ambassador, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for the opportunity. It's good to talk to you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Ambassador Derek for coming on the show. If you haven't yet done so, please take a second to share the Lawfare Podcast on social media and give us a rating and review wherever you found us. You can also now purchase Lawfare swag at our online store, www.thelawfarestore.com. The podcast is edited and produced by Jen Patya Howell. Our audio engineer this week was the indefatigable Michaela Fogel. Our music is, as always, performed by the one, the only Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.